Good morning to council. Are we ready to proceed with the next case? Looks like both council are ready. Very good. The next case on our calendar today is a consolidated matter, A22-170 and A23-0163. Jose Armando Padilla. I'm sorry, can you tell me how to pronounce Mr. Padilla's last name?
Padilla.
Padilla, versus State of Minnesota. We are proceeding by Zoom today, as you're aware. I'll just remind everyone who's watching that we are recording the oral argument today, and no other recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Council will each have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a timer that you can see in the grid view that shows how much time you have remaining. I'll ask that both counsel identify yourself and the party you re represent at the beginning of your argument. And counsel for appellant, thank you for helping me with the pronunciation. You can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant Jose Padilla. Mr. Padilla was improperly assigned a criminal history point for the 1205 drive-by of an unoccupied building. Section 2B1D of the 2017 guidelines state that only the two offenses at the highest severity levels are considered for prior multiple sentences arising out of a single course of conduct in which there were multiple victims. The district court, in response to this motion, determined that the drive-by of an unoccupied building was a separate behavioral incident from the assault and drive-by of an occupied building. Mr. Padilla contends that the district court abused its discretion in reaching this conclusion for at least two reasons. The first is that the district court's conclusion here directly contradicts its own conclusion. Conclusions on this issue, and the second is because there is a clear unity of time, place, and criminal objective that show that this was in fact a single behavioral incident.
Counsel, before you go further into your argument on this point, I'd like to discuss the burden of proof. And in your brief, you note that generally the prosecution has the burden of proving that the conduct at issue was not part of a single behavioral incident. But the Williams case says that the Williams case holds that when a defendant files a motion under Rule 27.03 to correct a sentence after the time for a direct appeal has passed, the defendant bears the burden of proving that his or her sentence was based on an incorrect criminal history score. So I'd like you to address in this context whether the defendant in Mr. Padilla in his motion to correct the sentence under Rule 27.03, where he raised this issue, had the burden to prove that his score was incorrect on this basis, based on Williams.
Yes, Your Honor, I think the way you explained Williams is correct, and it does say that after a direct appeal or after the time for a direct appeal, the defendant bears the burden of proving that. And I think in this case that Mr. Padilla is able to meet that burden, and kind of specifically the reason I think that he can meet that burden is because both the district court and panels of this court in that 2005 case have very specifically reached the conclusion that all of those events were part of a single behavioral incident. And I think one of the best places to look for that was that the district court did an order on August 7th of 2020 in case 34 CR 05 1276, which was the 2005 case. And in that case, for example, in paragraph 10 of the findings of fact, The court noted that the Court of Appeals found the sentences, consecutive sentences, to be appropriate. It also agreed that the events of the drive-by shootings and the first-degree assault were the same behavioral incident, but that sentences on all charges were proper under the multiple victim exception. And the court cited to State v. Padilla, which was the A080224. That was the decision by a panel of this court on March 24th of 2009. If we go further down in that order, still in the findings of fact, there's paragraph 13, which does essentially the same thing. Further into that order, there's a heading, conclusions of law. And under that, there is a subheading, substantially the same time and place. There, the district court noted that Padilla argues the offense of receiving slash possessing stolen property occurred when he took actual possession of the firearm while in the field near Wilmer in order to commit the drive-by shooting. The evidence in the record indicates that Padilla took possession of the firearm just prior to the shooting, which occurred early in the early morning hours of July 22, 2005. The record reflects the time of the drive-by shooting is approximately 12:44 a.m., July 22, 2005. There, the court cites to the trial transcripts at page 60 and then 108 through 122.
Counsel, are these district court orders in our record? And if they're not, are we allowed to take judicial notice of these orders?
As to the first part, I don't believe we submitted the full orders as part of the appendix, but we did provide the quotes that we're going through here as part of our briefing, and they are part of the judicial court record. So I think that the court can take notice of them as orders that
did
the district court has issued.
Did you submit them in this case before the district court? Did you provide these orders to the district court regarding the same behavioral incident issue?
I don't believe that we submitted the order, Your Honor, but I'm just checking that quickly. No, we submitted some transcripts from different cases, but we did not submit those as an order or as part of the exhibits.
And if they're not a part of our record on appeal, are they of the nature that we can take judicial notice of them, or are they outside the record and, you know, we really shouldn't be looking at prior orders and making this assessment? And I ask because I think that the state bore the burden in the initial case to prove the same behavioral. I think that this relates to Judge Cochran's question about how we look at the burden here and what your client's burden was to show whether these were part of the same behavioral incident.
Well, we believe, Your Honor, that this court has the ability to take judicial notice of these prior orders, as well as the court, the district court had cited to the Court of Appeals opinions in some of Mr. Padilla's prior appeals. And our position is that they're part of the judicial record, even if they weren't specifically submitted here as exhibits. They are orders in that case. And I do think that they have the effect of law and that the court should and could, can and should consider them. And so the other part was that the district court at the bottom of that substantially the same time place noted that the facts of the distance from the field to the mobile home park was about a mile and the parties are driven that approximate distance supports a substantial unity of both place and time. And then considering the same behavioral incident, the next heading down was conduct motivated by an effort to obtain the same criminal objective. There it notes that the record clearly demonstrates the criminal objective for the drive-by shootings was the murder or assault of RY and his family. The stolen firearm was used to accomplish this criminal objective in a seamless series of events, beginning from the retrieval of the stolen firearm from a field near Wilmer, proceeding directly to the two locations of the shootings, firing the gun, leaving the scene and being quickly apprehended by law enforcement officers. Under a heading called the record and burden of proof, the court again says, in this case, Padilla demonstrated that the receiving slash possessing stolen firearm property was part of a single behavioral incident. And then later said, since Padilla has shown that the offense of the receiving stolen property is part of the same behavioral incident as the drive-by shootings, he cannot be sentenced on that offense. And by doing so, his criminal history was incorrect, leading into his sentences for the drive-by shootings. And so our position is that these prior orders from the district court, as well as opinions from the Court of Appeals that were cited in them, pretty conclusively show that this was part of a single behavioral incident and ought to preclude a finding now that these were somehow separate events. And really what
Counsel,
the district...
That order that you're reading from was in the prior case, not in the current case involving the sentence or the drug conviction. Correct.
That is correct.
And given that it's a different case, is it, does the law of the case principle actually apply here since we have two different cases involving two different sentences?
I'm not certain that it does, Your Honor. I think the court ought to treat it as if it would, but I'm not certain that a law of the case would apply to a different district court case file number. However, what I do think, even if it's not the law of the case, is that it's particularly instructive on this question of whether these were separate behavioral incidents or all part of a same criminal objective, because what the district court did there was essentially address that three-part test that asks whether the conduct arose from a continuous and uninterrupted course of conduct, occurred at substantially the same time and place, and manifested an indivisible state of mind or were motivated by a single criminal objective. And what we can see is that the district court, for example, cites to specific testimony from witness Saldanada, and says, you know, that supports a substantial unity of time and place. And I don't think there's anything that's changed since that August 2022 order and now that would justify a different conclusion. Or, for example,
I agree with you that there's some tension between this August 2020 order and the more current October 2022 order, which are from two different cases, but they address a similar issue. But the order that we have on appeal does have some additional discussion of the transcript and notes that the same criminal object, or the court concludes that the same criminal objective does not link the two shootings. The trial record indicates that, and I'm reading from the October 2022 order on addendum page 6, the trial record indicates that one participant admitted he knew the mobile home was not occupied and the Gordon Avenue residence was occupied. The same criminal objective did not link the shootings of the empty mobile home to the residence with eight persons inside. The two drive-by shooting crimes are independent and are not a continuous course of conduct. So the district court in this case, and I believe it was the same judge as the earlier case, maybe I'm wrong about that, but, you know, looked, it appears to me that the district court judge focused in on some additional testimony in the transcript to reach the decision the district court reached in this case. And so, you know, from your perspective, why isn't isn't the reasoning in this more current order appropriate in terms of the analysis of whether these two drive-by shooting crimes were part of the same course of conduct, given the factors that we are to consider?
Sure. Well, I think there's, I guess I have two parts to that. Number one is that we have in this case, several panels of this court have essentially affirmed the district court decision in the earlier case stating that these are all part of a single behavioral incident. And I think they did that because they concluded the same way that they were. But the other thing is, if we look at that earlier order, it analyzed essentially the same thing. And it concluded that the things on the two opposite ends, which were the receiving stolen property, which was when Mr. Padilla allegedly retrieved the gun, and then the drive-by of the occupied building, were all part of the same behavioral incident. And the drive-by of an unoccupied building was in between those two. And I think that what it does show, especially with really the only criminal objective was to harm RY and or his family, that we do have the unity of time, place, and criminal objective here that in fact make these part of the single behavioral incident. And I think that it's it doesn't make sense that now when Mr. Padilla raises it here, that there's a different conclusion. And I think that it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to now make those different kind of findings and conclude that given all the times it's been decided in the past. Now, I just want to address briefly, Mr. Padilla, as part of this is requesting essentially under the logic in the state case v. Kralik, which had said essentially was involved a case where an individual's 12 months that he shouldn't have on a DUI, and then a panel of this court reduced a current sentence from 36 to 24 months in order to prevent the defendant from erroneously spending more time in jail than he should have as part of that. And I think under that same kind of logic here, Mr. Padilla has shown that he served an additional 447 days in prison prior to his supervised release that he shouldn't have in that 2005 case. And he just is requesting that he have an order that gives him the credit or recognizes that so that he does not end up erroneously spending time in jail where there is a means to remedy it, as the court in Kralik noted that would be inappropriate. And the way that 447 days works is that by the time Mr. Padilla got his sentence fully corrected in or around 2000, he had a supervised release date of September 30th of 2016, but he wasn't released on supervised release until May 30th of 2017, which was 242 days. And then the remainder of that comes from the fact that his criminal history score was increased by the drive-by of an unoccupied building, which would have made his release date March 9th, 2016, which is 447 days from May 30th of 2017. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Also for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, Shane Baker, Canadrac County Attorney, appearing for the state. There are a number of individual issues in this, and most of them, or they've been addressed in the brief. I just want to maybe highlight kind of overarching issues that may affect how the court goes about its analysis. First, to what end is all this? We had a lot of argument, should we count the unoccupied building? There's whether you count the threats of violence point. When it comes down to it, even if you accept appellant's version of which points do or don't count, it's still at 7. And 7 would keep the range of his sentence the same. His criminal history score has not changed. It's 6 or more. The horizontal axis on the grid is the score, and it ends at 6 or more. There is no score of 8, 9, 10, 11. It's 6 or more. And when that's the case, you don't need to do resentencing. And provost,
counsel, what case would you cite us to support your position that, you know, even if we were to agree with appellant on one or more of his arguments regarding the criminal history score, that we wouldn't need to remand for resentencing? You're having some video issues. I assume that's why you turned the video off.
It went off on zone and I flicked back on. On the question, I heard the question. First, I'd go to provost, which indicates that you do resentencing when the grid range moves up or down. Because the grid range has not moved up or down, the reason for resentencing doesn't apply. And then my other, it'd be more on the language of the guidelines themselves. So it's statutory rule-based, not case law-based.
Thank you.
Mr. Baker, on that point, just to clarify, how would you interpret the agreement for sentencing? I thought I read the phrase that there was an anticipation of 128 months, and that is what the judge imposed. That seems a little bit distinct to an agreed amount. And so would that factor in our decision in terms of whether it needs to be remanded for sentencing, even if it's within the same range, but there's a significant range and now a significant difference in points? Would that violate the plea agreement, or was the plea agreement simply within that range with an anticipation of course, now there's been a lot of unanticipated consequences over the years?
On that issue, the agreement was for middle of the box. So I wouldn't say that it's for a specific amount. It was anticipated that there would be max criminal history score. So I guess that's what I'm saying is the score itself hasn't changed. The felony points may or may not change, but the criminal history score has not changed.
So your point being there'd be no discretion for the court to do other than the middle of the box, which would not change under the point difference, is your main point here today.
Right. And because there's the rule for 2703 motions are when there's a change in score, there hasn't been a change in score.
Even if we were to agree with you in terms of whether a remand is necessary, isn't it still important that this court address each of the specific arguments regarding whether the criminal history score is correct?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that it's waiting. It's kind of like the whole a lot of the history of this case is a piecemeal approach to these issues when they should be addressed in single moments, a single appeal or challenge, and not go over 15 or so years. A lot of times the Rule 2703 arguments mention the phrase at any time. What it misses is the word may. The court may address them. And I think it just highlights the need for NAFLA-like policies in place to when those are addressed. So I think it just creates arguments on issues that don't need to be addressed.
But couldn't there be future implications for Mr. Padilla if we don't address some of the issue that he's raised in this appeal in the future?
And it would be the future cases where they should be brought. Because maybe by that time, the points will have decayed, so then it's a non-issue, for example. So that'd be a reason not to address a question that doesn't need to be. Now, all my argument, there's one caveat to that, is that's the custody enhancement rule, because that would change the range and would then mandate a remand for a resentencing. But there are three bases why the custody status point applies here and that it doesn't change. Appellant has argued that the 2019 changes apply to him. They don't for three reasons. First,
counsel, can we instead turn to the question of whether the two drive-by shootings are part of the same course of conduct, whether the district court properly analyzed that in its more recent, in its October 2022 order? That was the focus of the appellant's argument. I have some questions for you on that issue.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'll note that it's never been an issue actually raised until recently, which means that when, for example, the 2009 appeal in the other case, and that's a distinction that needs to be made, it's not the law of that case, they're different cases. The issues there was the first degree assault and the occupied shooting. They were not looking at whether the two drive-by shootings were part of the same behavioral incident. They're not examining that. They weren't examining that up to the 2020 case. That was the receiving stolen property versus the drive-by shooting. It wasn't looking whether the drive-by shootings to each other.
But the district court did have to make that determination in 2005 during sentencing, correct?
No, it didn't, because it related it to a different charge, which was the attempted murder charge.
So is it your position the district court has never decided, and no district court has ever decided at any point, whether these were part of the same behavioral incident? Is that your position?
It's certainly never been challenged by the defendant till now. And
well, the defendant wouldn't challenge it if the defendant agreed with the district court's analysis.
Well, the first time they would have challenged,
if the state didn't prove that they were part of the same behavioral incident in 2005, that would have been the time to prove that, not in this case.
Well, it'd been 2007. Because first the sentencing was on the second degree attempted murder. That was reversed. It went back for sentencing. And then at that 2007 sentence, there was convictions and sentences entered on both drive-by shootings. from that sentence, the only thing challenged was whether the first degree assault and the occupied drive-by shooting charges were the same behavioral incident.
But
there was no
going back to Judge Larson's point, doesn't the language in the August 2020 order suggest that the district court viewed the receipt of stolen property in both drive-by shootings as part of the same course of conduct when it says the fact that the distance from the field to the mobile home park was about a mile and the parties were driven that approximate distance supports a finding of both unity of time and place. And it's talking about both shootings. And then it says in terms of the same criminal objective, it says the firearm was used to accomplish, or the record clearly demonstrates that the criminal objective for drive-by shootings, plural, was the murder or assault of Ruben Ybarra and his family.
It may seem that way, but also it wasn't the issue raised in the case. And certainly the state wasn't dealing with that as whether that's what the court should be looking at, was whether they're part of the same behavioral incident. It was the possession of the gun versus the other things, not whether they relate to each other. And as the court indicated before, that's the 2005 case that doesn't apply here. So now that the judge
can you point me to a case that says that when evaluating, you know, prior criminal history for the purpose of sentencing in a future case, that the district court is not bound by the prior sentencing decisions of in those actual cases? I mean, I think that you can tell there's something that I find uncomfortable about this issue being raised in a future case and not being raised in the actual case where the sentencing occurred.
I guess I'm trying to understand the question. I guess that's it. Just highlights why all this should have been brought when it was in play in 2007. Now we're 15, 16 years later, arguing something that should have been addressed that long ago, as far as whether they are the same behavioral incident or not.
In 2007, did the state argue that they were part of the same behavioral incident? Or I mean, were not part of the same behavioral incident?
In the extent that saying that the points would count and that they each would be sentenced separately, yes. That's, I think, the implication of that they're sentenced separately. And they have been.
Thank you.
Just to clarify, Mr. Baker, though, it is common, of course, as we have before us now, in looking at a current sentencing, when the issue of points is raised, that whether an incident was part of the same conduct necessarily, even if it's never been litigated, it's important on the current case because the points is relevant. So I assume my experience too is often attorneys at the trial court level don't think about it, don't talk about it, and the court just sentences because the PSI has it and there we go. And it's not till a subsequent case when it becomes very important because of the points. And so necessarily we have to look back in time to calculate it.
Oh, that's true. And to that degree, then it's the 2017 sentencing, or then it should have been raised. When he was being sentenced on this particular file for the first degree drug case, and it was counted, and that's where the defense attorney said, in effect, kind of my argument is like, no matter how you count him, his score is going to be at the max level, so the 128 applies.
And might that go to the burden of proof, though? It's still relevant, but as Judge Cochran pointed out from the Williams case, that perhaps that's what shifted initially. It would have been the state's burden if it was raised, but because it wasn't, perhaps it's a different burden, but it's still appropriate for us to review the district court's analysis.
Correct. I see I have 2:39 left. Let's I go to the other issue raised in the oral argument here regarding the time off his sentence. And I think that's the distinction in his reply brief where he gets it wrong. Is I'm not saying he's attacking the plea agreement because of this challenge on points, because the agreement was for middle of the box, and that would be wherever the score ends up. But when you start getting into the, I should get a sentencing departure because of some so-called overpunishment and incarceration, then you're attacking, it's a departure, it's a durational departure, and the agreement was for middle of the box guideline sentence. So now that he had his agreement with middle of the box, now he wants a departure and to get that additional credit. You know, and I suppose I should highlight, it's not credit in the sense of jail credit, because it was served before even the crime itself was committed. It's a departure, like Kralik said. So that removes it from a Rule 2703 motion, and it can't be addressed by the district court in that vehicle. So we argue that on that basis, it should be denied. Custody status points issue I brought up in the brief. I think it's his case was final, but I'd like to highlight that's what's going on here. There's been a melding of the 2005 case and 2017 case, and remembering which is the actual case. But the language of the guidelines themselves say 1 point applies because it's a higher level felony. It's supervised relief, any felony. And then even if it's a half a point, the plain language of the guidelines say you assign the 3 month enhancement. And that's key because that keeps the range and the center box the same, regardless of whether the felony points drop from 9 to 8 to 7. And that's all my argument is. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You're on mute.
You're still on mute.
Sorry about that, Your Honor. I apologize. I think that counsel argued sort of indirectly that there ought to be sort of a NAFLA-like rule applied here. I would just note that I think that the case in Mr. Padilla's materials that addresses that most directly is State v. Amundson, which says that NAFLA doesn't apply. I think that is kind of the precedent that's applicable here, and I don't think that there's any reason to change that or to depart from that. So I don't think there's any NAFLA issues or procedural bars that would deal with this. And part of the distinction, I think, is there's a difference between whether or not Mr. Padilla can be sentenced on all of these things, which would have been the issue in 2005. And then there's an issue regarding whether or not points can be assessed for all of these things, which is what we're trying to deal with right now. And so that's why the argument wouldn't have been made in 2005 or 2007, because at that point, he wasn't dealing with trying to have this point for the drive-by of an unoccupied assessed and whether or not it was one of the two highest severity level offenses. And so I think that's part of the distinction on that and why it wasn't addressed squarely back then, but still can be now. And then as far as—
How do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that it should have been brought in 2017 or in the 2017 sentencing?
Well, I think from Mr. Padilla's perspective, he would have liked to have seen that it was made sure in 2017 that his criminal history points were correct and that it was fully addressed at that point. But I think that Rule 27.03 does, it says may be addressed at any time, but the Supreme Court has said specifically that problems with criminal history points are situations where a sentence is unauthorized, and if you have that, then it needs to be addressed. And so I don't think there's any kind of bar to addressing it now at this time. And so that's why we've brought it here, because I think that it is appropriate to be addressed and that the court can do so. And then the last thing,
Mr. Longsdorf, I didn't interpret, although I did reference NAFLA, that it was a forfeited type of bar, but we oftentimes will, based on our analysis, consider a particular remedy that sought as premature. And he made a good point that obviously if it has no impact on sentence, it would only have an impact on future crimes and a calculation Wouldn't it be at that time then appropriate to raise? And they would look at our case saying it's premature, so we don't address that.
Well, maybe there's two different parts to that. One is, for example, opposing counsel discussed provost, and that says if criminal history scores move, then sentences tend to move, so there needs to be a resentencing. And here, if the criminal history score doesn't get low enough to move the sentence, then there probably doesn't need to be a resentencing on that particular part of it. But on the other hand, I don't think there's anything that says that Mr. Padilla shouldn't have a correct criminal history score on this case or any other case if he raises the issue. And I do think that if we just look at Rule 27.03, it's sort of its face value. That's what it's there to correct. And it's important to Mr. Padilla that his criminal history score be corrected. But I also do think that the other issue here is the additional and unwarranted time that Mr. Padilla served. And I don't think that the points or anything would have any impact on that, and whether or not Mr. Padilla ought to get that sort of, not custody credits, not exactly the right way, but ought to have that taken into consideration to make sure that he isn't double punished on that. And so I do think that this is an issue that's ripe for the court to decide.
Did I understand then you propose,
go ahead.
A proposed remedy where it would be a reverse and remand, but not for resentencing, but simply to instruct the correction of the points. Did I understand that correctly?
Well, I do think that Mr. Padilla wants to make sure that his points are correct, and that would be an appropriate remedy for that, and then also to address the Krawlik type issue. Just have a second.
Can I ask you just briefly about the terroristic threats conviction and your argument relating to that? Respondent notes that there's nothing that indicates that the 232 days were for Yellow Medicine County, that jail time was credited. So, and I think the sentencing worksheet also reflects that the sentence expired after July 22, 2002. Can you address that?
That's correct, Your Honor. If you look at the one he's challenging is the one that ends in 369.
Right.
When it was executed, he was given credit for 120 days. Our position is, if you look at the transcripts, and we did provide those as exhibits in cases 597 and 598, it shows that he actually had the credit for 232 days during that period. And if you add all that up, it would put his completion date ahead of July 22nd of 2002, which is outside the 15 years. Absent
when you say he did have credit for it, but I don't think that the record reflects that he sought credit for it at the time of sentencing. Am I wrong about that?
I don't know if I have if I recall the transcript from 369, but it appears that he didn't suggest that he should have received all that credit then.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, are there any other questions from the panel? No. Okay, you can briefly sum up, thank you.
No, that's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you to both counsel for your arguments here today. They were very helpful for the panel. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe.